for a couple of days, and then I got to meet her day before yesterday. And she is so cute, and she's got this great sense of humor, and she's real deep. She's a very deeply spiritual person, and I know y'all are going to enjoy listening to you talk.
You're so cute. I'm deep. My name is Utah Kaiser, and I am an alcoholic. Oh, let's see how deep I can get. First of all, I would like to thank the committee for inviting me. It's an honor and a privilege to be asked to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous at whatever level. And I know today all I'm supposed to do is show up, and the God of my understanding does the rest. And I would also like to thank the committee for the lovely accommodation and for the basket. I mean, it is just loaded with just so much fun stuff. I don't know, did the other speakers get lottery tickets? You didn't? And I don't understand, in my basket was this blow-up thing here. And it says, contains mature audience content. Now, did y'all get that too, speakers? Or is someone trying to tell me something here? Oh, me. But I was, thank you. Thank you for the invite. And also, I would like to thank my hostess, Gracie, for being here. And also, I would like to thank my road warrior, Lisa, who is our incoming Area 1, Alabama, Northwest Florida alternate delegate. And we've been on the road a while, and for some reason people have commenced to call us Thelma and Louise. And they, on the road, when we're on the road together, I don't know what it is, some aura or something, the truckers just move away and give us wide berths, you know. And if we carry bags, they are really worried. You know, they're really worried. So I am grateful for Lisa to be here also. Make her welcome. This is, my heart just goes out because just across the river in Alabama, is where I growed up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not from here, and my name is strange, I know that, especially if you look at the program, it says J-U-T-T-A, and you wonder what a Jutta is. Well, it is it is pronounced Utah, and it's German, and the J is silent, and there was an H on the end that Mom dropped, and growing up, it was just easier to say it's pronounced Utah like the state. And since I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's been very strange. You know, everywhere we go, we don't always wear name badges. So somebody will see me and meet me. And I was in Lowe's the other day, well, a little while ago, and someone hollered, "Hey, New Mexico." And, you know, I knew they were talking to me because I've been called Dallas, Idaho, Wyoming, Choctaw, Albuquerque, you know, you name it. But the name is Utah, and that's all right. And a lot of people have started to call me Jetta. And to southernize it, they say Jetta May. So it doesn't matter. Oh, now, I've heard all about these lovely home groups, the best in the world. Well, the one thing I would like to read to you is in our 12 and 12, and it says, any two or three alcoholics gathered together for sobriety may call themselves an AA group, provided that as a group they have no other affiliation. I belong to On the Porch group, in Magnolia Springs, Alabama. We meet on Wednesdays, and it's two or three alcoholics gathered together for sobriety, and we have no other affiliation. If you want to join us on the porch in Magnolia Springs, please come. Please come on Wednesday. And it is divinely inspired. It is in-depth, taking the steps out of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, word for word, page for page. Every time it gives a direction, we follow the directions, and we don't go further until we finish. And if you would like to take the steps with us, please join us. It is by the grace of a loving God that I met in our second tradition that I've been sober since February 23rd, 1990. And any success that I have is far more his success than it is mine. Because I don't do this, especially this microphone stuff. And that light is so bright, you know. I'm pretending I'm embraced by the sunlight of the Spirit here. Y'all are lucky I got clothes on, because usually I don't when I'm embraced by the sunlight of the Spirit. Because y'all should... I mean, y'all should have heard me this morning. When I was in the shower, and that's my quiet time with God, I made the best talk. I mean, you should have been there. It was wonderful. I don't know what I'm going to say now, but that one was good. Our stories disclose in a general way what we were like, what happened, and what we're like now. And in a general way, I could share with you what Dr. Silkworth shared with Lois about Bill's drinking. And to adapt it to my drinking, it was my drinking, once a habit, became an obsession, a true insanity that condemned me to drink against my will. And that was it. I have a progressive and a fatal illness. And it was so slow that I never knew that I was an alcoholic. I grew up in a home. I was born in Heidelberg, Germany. Karitha, yay, we're bonded here. She was in Heidelberg. That's where I was born, so that's good. And because of the military, I was adopted at 3 1/2 and was brought to the United States and did a lot of traveling. There was a lot of love in our home. I can share that with you today. But for some reason, it wasn't enough. There just wasn't enough. I never liked who I was, where I was, doing what I was doing, or who I was doing it with. It's all about change, you know. Thank God I was raised in the military. There was booze in the home growing up. Dad drank beer, mom drank wine, and they did hard liquor. There was not a problem, to my knowledge, in our home with alcohol. It's interesting, though, the big book shares with me what we have is a family illness. And I believe that today, because I have a brother 2 years younger than me that, celebrated 14 years of continuous sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have another brother 6 years younger than I am. And what's interesting, 7 years ago, he just stopped drinking. And my youngest brother, the very youngest one, drank the way I drank and did a lot of the things I did. And when he said, "Utah, I've just stopped drinking," and I go, "Well, how do you do that?" And he said the doctor told him if he didn't stop drinking, he was going to die before his time. My youngest brother is not an alcoholic. He is what the big book describes as a hard drinker. Given a sufficient reason, the hard drinker can stop drinking. And he was given a sufficient reason. Now, I was given sufficient reasons to stop drinking, and I could not. I could not stop. Breathe. Growing up, I don't know what, I guess it was a the way I learned how to cope with life. But I learned at an early age how to lie and how to cheat and how to steal. And I'm a people pleaser. Please like me, you know, so I do all these things so you'll like me. But if you ever knew what was going on within me, you wouldn't like me. So that was the way I coped. Went to 10 different schools in 12 years. Again, there was booze in the home, and it wasn't a problem. I had sips here and there. Being raised in the military, there were times that we couldn't go with my dad. He did 3 tours of duty in Vietnam, so those were times, or he did TDY, and we couldn't go. And home base for us was Loosedale, Mississippi. That is just the other side of Mobile, Alabama. So Dad had gone to Vietnam, and I was we were in Mississippi at the time, and I had my first date. I was 16 years old. My date picked me up. We went to a drive-in movie. They had drive-ins. This is a dry county, by the way. And he had slow gin. Now, I didn't know anything about booze at this time, but he fixed a drink. And, of course, this is before Styrofoam. It was, God, let's see, 67. Yeah, I think it was 1967. But he fixed a drink, and I remember that when I drank this slow gin with whatever, that it was sweet and it was sticky and it kind of, you know, hung around there a little bit. And nothing happened. But what happened was he fixed another drink. Now, when that second drink went down, potential alcoholic that I was, for the first time in my 16 years, I liked who I was. I liked where I was. I liked doing what I was doing and who I was doing it with. And I had a good time. The last thing I remember, because I commenced to drink, was the windows in the vehicle were fogged up. And I have no idea what the movie was, you know. And so I enjoyed what alcohol did to me. Slow gin, it didn't matter. It was wonderful, wonderful. I got drunk, and what was interesting about my first drunk was the next morning I did not have a hangover. And the next morning, my mom did not ground me. I was raised with an iron fist. What I realized today, mom was very, very strict with me. And she didn't want the same thing that happened to her to happen to me because I was born out of wedlock. So she was very strict. Well, she didn't ground me for coming home drunk. You know, I don't even remember coming home drunk. So I figured if this is what it is to like who I am and like what I'm doing and who I'm doing it with, I want to do it more often. I didn't really like to have to lie to you, and I didn't really like to have to steal or cheat, but it's what I had to do unless I was drinking. I didn't get drunk every time I went out after that. At 16, it's rather challenging, even though they did have the bootleggers and the white lightning, but it was not something that I did. I graduated from Carroll High School in Ozark, and Malvin is here from Ozark. Dad went to Vietnam again, and I commenced to go to college. And the reason I went to college is that's what you do. In 1969, and I am a child of the 60s, but for some reason, I didn't get involved in any of the child of the 60s stuff. I mean, I loved booze too much. So I went to nursing school in Mobile, Alabama, and I'm not a nurse. I'm not nursing material. I'm not kind. I'm not compassionate, and I'm not loving. If you are sick, help yourself. But I go to nursing school because I'm going to please my mama. She wanted to be a nurse and couldn't be a nurse. So, because she had me. So I'm going to make her happy and I'm going to fulfill her dreams and be a nurse. What nursing school and college in Mobile introduced me to were fraternity parties. Oh, yes. I love fraternity parties. They had kegs of beer, and they had dancing, and there was lots of drinking. Guys, lots of guys. And I enjoyed the fraternity parties, and I didn't really like school too much. I mean, it got in the way of partying. I don't understand that. But I was asked at one of my classes, an English class, to write a paper and write a poem. And the poem, whatever, I don't even know if there was a topic, but it was, this is your assignment, write a poem. Well, I'm busy and I don't have time to write a poem, so I copied one. It was a poem that I'd never heard and never saw. So that's what you do. And I turned that paper in, and I got the paper back, and it had an F on it. Now, F does not disturb me because throughout my growing up in school, I knew how to make an A out of an F. But what disturbed me about this paper was the word underneath that said plagiarism. And I had to look the word up. And when I looked it up and I saw what it meant, I went, oh, no. This instructor knows that I did not write this poem. I could not show up for class anymore. So I didn't, because he's going to know that I cheated. But I continued to party. And I loved, again, the fraternity parties and the drinking and the just everything about it. After a little while, I met this guy that was not in school and 6 years older than me, and commenced to move in with him. Got a job. What this guy introduced me to, though, were the bars in Mobile. You could be 18 in Mobile at this time and drink. So I was introduced to the bars. And that was even more better than the fraternity parties, because they had all the smoke and all the lights and all the live bands and all the different kind of booze, and I loved it. I mean, the bands resonated within my soul. You hear the bass and you hear the Motown, and oh, yes. And I was going, I like this. We don't cause harm. That was what I thought. I was not hurting anyone but myself, is what I thought. But I can share with you today that we cause emotional, we cause mental, we cause spiritual harm. For a whole year, my mom did not know where I was. She thought I was still in school, and her being foreign, she didn't know how to check to see where I was, what kind of harm I caused my mom. I stayed in that relationship in Mobile for a couple of years, and I worked and I showed up for work and I drank and I partied and did, you know, but it was all right. It's just my drinking once a habit. It's what everyone else was doing. After a couple of years, I got out of this relationship, and I was invited to a party in Gulf Shores, Alabama, which is on the Gulf of Mexico. And it was an Auburn, Alabama party. And I had no idea what that was. I knew I was living in the state of Alabama, and I thought Auburn was a hair color. But I knew what party was, so I go to Gulf Shores to this party, and oh my gosh, I found out it's football. I didn't know that. And so I go to this party, and oh my gosh, and by the way, Auburn's playing right now. And I met the man of my dreams at this party. I found out that if you are cunning, baffling, and powerful, you can get what you want when you want it. And so I conned and I manipulated, and after this party, it took a couple of months. And I got a blind date with this wonderful man. And he came to Mobile and picked me up, and he was blind. I was not. I knew exactly what I wanted and who I wanted. And he introduced me to another level of drinking. It is called, on the beach, it's called Pink Pony Pub, Florabama, Gulf Gate Lodge. I mean, skinny dipping the sun and the sand and the full moon and the Gulf of Mexico and salt water, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. So we were dating, and we back and forth every day, every weekend, excuse me, and I'm going back to Gulf Shores from Mobile and spending my paycheck and his paycheck at these bars, and it was wonderful. After about 6 months of this going back and forth, I don't know about you, but I got the rids. It's called restless, irritable, discontented. And something's got to change. You know, I'm used to moving. I'm used to just doing. And now I have to be, you know. So I'm going to be a flight attendant. I love people, which I do. And I love to travel, which I do. I speak German, which I don't. And I don't know how to pack. So if I go to flight attendant school, I'll learn how to pack and be able to travel. So I have these applications to be a flight attendant on the dash of my car. And my future husband says, "What is this?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to be a flight attendant." And this is before relationship was a word. And he said, "Well, what about us?" And I said, "What about us?" And he started stuttering as such. And I looked at him, and with all the earnestness at my command, I said, "Oh, do you want to get married?" And he said, "Yes." So we got married. What a, you know, I mean, that's all you got to do, ask. That's it. You think it's challenging? No, it's not. So we got married, and we were married for 16 and a half years, and he is a beautiful man, a wonderful man, a loving man. We married and we partied a lot, and then we got involved in the community. When you live in a tourist town, you work hard and you party hard. And so we drank, but we were also responsible in our drinking. Now, I should have known he had a problem, because before children, we would be out partying on the weekends, and he would look at me sometimes and he would say, "Utah, I think I've had too much to drink. And I feel out of control. Would you drive?" And this is before I knew about inventory. And, you know, I took an inventory and I go, "Well, you know, I've had a lot to drink, probably as much as you, if not more. And I feel in control. So, yes, I will drive." So all these times I'm driving and, you know, not knowing that that's part of alcoholism, that I feel in control. And so we had a lovely joining, a lovely honeymoon that lasted for 6 years. And then after that, we had our first child. Her name is Andrea. And she is the wind beneath my wings. She's 28, and lest I forget, I've got to share this with you. She is in Gulf Shores, and in May, she's going to make me a grandmother. God willing, you know, God willing. And so we had Andrea, and what a joy. And the God of my understanding is so loving and so gracious. Because the two times that I was pregnant, the only thing that made me sick was alcohol. And I did not know that you weren't supposed to drink when you were pregnant. It was just what made me sick. So we had Andrea in 1978, and then 1979, we survived Hurricane Frederick, which took away our home and all of our belongings. And that, you know, it's okay. You just start all over. I am drinking the whole time, but again, my drinking was just a habit. You have social hours, you have cocktail parties, you entertain, you're being entertained. So it was just part of the deal. In 1980, after Frederick, we started our own real estate business in Gulf Shores. And that's a whole new ball game. My husband did real estate sales and I did property management because I don't want to have to live with you for 6 months, but I want to make you happy for 1 week or 2 weeks, and I can do that. Now, it was kind of frustrating, you know, when I had no control over the weather or whether there were jellyfish in the Gulf of Mexico. It kind of gave me a little edge every now and then. In 1981, we had our second daughter. Her name is Erin, and she is my sunshine. She's 25, and my God, does she ever light up a room? She does. She just is right out there. I blame Erin on my morning drinking, because after we had Erin, I wanted to get rid of baby fat. So we lived on an island at the time, and so I started jogging, and I jogged around this island, and after a little bit, and I'm not athletic, you know, it's just I was doing this to lose weight, and I ran finally 6.2 miles, which is a 10K. I ran in my first 10K in Pensacola, Florida, Fiesta of Five Flags, and what was, I had arrived. In the big book, it talks in Bill's story where he had arrived. And I had arrived. I identified with that in Bill's story because I ran in my first 10K in Pensacola. And it was wonderful. There was applause. There was all of this. I had a good tan, you know, just all this good stuff, and I was fit. And after I got through running, they had all the Coke and all the Gatorade you could drink here, and they had all the beer you could drink here. And I don't drink Coke. And I don't drink Gatorade. But I drink beer. So 9 o'clock in the morning, I'm drinking beer. And guess what? I am off to the races. I ran every day after that. And I don't care if it's 6 miles or 8 miles or 10 miles. I deserve to drink. So that started my morning drinking. The progressiveness of my allergy, of my illness, of my malady started there, where it started manifesting itself in my life, where it became an obsession. And that's when that started. So my obsession kicked in. I'm going to run every day, and then I show up for work and do what I need to do and can't wait till I get off from work. And after a few years of this, you know, when you get off from work, and I had the girls, and I just needed to kick in my second shift. You know, bathing the girls, homework, cooking supper, and I just wanted to get the edge off. You know, these tourists can be so demanding. And so I just wanted to chill a little bit. So there was this wonderful television show that I would watch while I'm cooking. And this chef was Cajun. And he cooked with wine. And he drank wine, and he cooked with wine. And I liked that. So I started, just to get the edge off, to cook with wine and drink with wine. And it was wonderful. I mean, we had a lot of wonderful meals, but what happened was I started having blackouts because I'm drinking a lot of wine. I have no idea what I'm cooking. Thank you, Carol. She is so divine. She is so divine. So I'm cooking with wine and I'm drinking wine and I'm going into blackouts, and I don't know what I'm cooking, when I'm cooking, how I'm cooking it, how the kitchen gets clean, but it is all happening. My speech is becoming slurred, and my husband comments, "Utah, don't you think you're drinking too much?" Once again, before inventory, I took an inventory. He thinks I'm drinking too much, and I haven't had enough. So how could I be drinking too much? And to please him, so he wouldn't say anything bad to me, I hid the wine. Now, these are these big old green bottles, you know, the big ones. And they're a challenge to hide unless you have a gumbo pot this big. And so I hid the wine in this huge gumbo pot in the pantry, and I had glasses stashed all over the house. Because I had gotten to the place where I needed to have something in me all the time. Now, this is the progression of my alcoholism. And this continues until a wonderful friend said, "Utah, did you know you can't smell vodka?" I did not know that. I had no idea that you couldn't smell vodka. So forget this big old bottle of this green wine that, you know, the bottle of green that where you had to hide it. Out comes the vodka. The gallons of vodka, and they do fit in the tank of the toilet. And it does fit in the dirty clothes hamper. And I am at the point in my progression of alcoholism where I am drinking vodka around the clock. It was not for the taste, I can tell you that. It was for the effect. I drink for the effect. So I'm drinking the vodka around the clock without him knowing it. My speech is slurred. I'm having a lot of blackouts, and he's concerned about me. "Utah, what is wrong with you?" This is the only part of my story that includes drugs. I would buy over-the-counter sinus medicine. And I don't know if it was Actifed, Fetafed, or Sudafed, or whatever, but it was whatever on the box that said, "May cause drowsiness. Do not operate heavy equipment." Because when he would comment about my behavior, I would tell him my sinuses went crazy, and I had to take the sinus medicine. I never took it. I mean, who needs it? I just needed the box. Kind of like my Bozo box here. Contains mature audience content, you know. So I needed the box as proof for my what was wrong with me. I had to really drink a lot before. We were active in the community, active in the church, active in civic, you name it. We were participated in all of that. And I had to drink a lot before I went to church. And we went to church faithfully on Sunday or sometimes Saturday night because that religion preached it. That's a good word. And I would drink a lot before I went to church because I would do everything they're doing in church. When they knelt, I knelt. When they prayed, I prayed. When they sang, I sang. When they chanted, I chanted. I was dipped and dunked and sprayed and ashed and oiled. I did all of that, and you know what? I'm looking at you in this congregation, and I'm going, what am I missing? What is wrong with me? Why don't I feel what I'm seeing that you're experiencing? I don't feel peaceful. I don't feel serenity. I certainly do not feel joy. What is wrong with me? So this particular Sunday, I drink a lot, and I go into a blackout. We get back from church, and I fix Sunday dinner. And then we go bike riding as a family. I could not balance the bicycle, and the bicycle crashes. And when the bicycle crashes, I come out of the blackout. I mean, I'm there. Next thing I know, I'm right there. And I am sober or awake. I'm not sure which one. And my husband is concerned about me. He said, "Oh, my God, what's wrong with you?" And he thought that my sinuses had just exploded. Or he thought I had a brain tumor because of my behavior. And he said, "We need to go to the doctor." And I said, "No, it's Sunday. I'll be okay. We'll go tomorrow." I didn't drink anything after that. And the next day, we go to Pensacola to the doctor, and I'm doing some kind of shaking. And I can't fill out any forms, and they x-ray my head, and my sinuses are fine, and I didn't have a brain tumor. And the doctor said, "Utah, how much do you drink?" And I just went, well, I have two every now and then. He didn't know they were continuous two. Going from this drink to that drink, from this drink to that drink. And he said, well, you may have a problem with alcohol, or you may be having a nervous breakdown. Big book. Some of us have grave emotional and mental disorders. And I said, that's it. I'm having a nervous breakdown. I mean, seriously, stop and think. If you had to control the universe like I did, you would have a nervous breakdown, too. People just don't do right. They just do not do right, you know? And you can't tell them that. So I go into treatment, and the doctor suggested the alcoholic floor. And if you don't fit there, we're going to move you to this other floor where they take care of people that have nervous breakdowns. I'm a people pleaser, so I stayed on the alcoholic floor. And I stayed in treatment for 21 days. I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was introduced to Overeaters Anonymous, and I was introduced to Narcotics Anonymous, and I was introduced to all these Anonymouses. And I said, I'm going to start Meetings Anonymous. The only requirement for Meetings Anonymous is don't show up. So I get out of treatment after 21 days, and, you know, I start going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in Gulf Shores. And the gift of that was the fact that they continued to allow me to go to those meetings. The only thing that changes in my life is I'm going to meetings and I'm not drinking. My number one resentment in Alcoholics Anonymous is meeting makers make it. Ooh. Because I go to meetings and I come home, and I go to meetings, I come home, and I go to meetings and I come home, and I ain't taking a drink. Another resentment, just don't drink and go to meetings. Ooh. If I could just not drink, why would I need to go to meetings? You know? So I do this for 6 months, and I pick up my chips that they offer. And after 6 months, my husband decides that he loves someone else. Oh, Lordy. Now, how does one cope with that? I didn't understand that. I know today I'm powerless over alcohol, and I am powerless over midlife crisis. And I hung in there knowing that he loved someone else, and I could not go back to the office because what are they going to think of me? So I'm not drinking, going to meetings, and that's it. Nothing changes except my husband has thrown a monkey wrench into our relationship. It was my perception. And I get a part-time job delivering flowers. And I had just picked up my 9 months chip, and it was February 14th, Valentine's Day, and this is a busy day in the florist, and so I delivered flowers up and down the beach, and I had heard in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous HALT, H-A-L-T, and it stands for hungry, angry, lonely, tired. And I came home that evening, and our two daughters were there because my husband and I were divorced at the time, and I had custody of Andrea and Aaron. And I came home, and my God, you know, I was hungry. I hadn't had time to eat. I was angry because no one loved me. And I was lonely because my ex-husband came and picked up our two daughters and took them out to dinner for Valentine's, and I was tired because of just the physical exertion. And I made a decision that evening as I was home alone, if this is what it is to be sober, I don't want it. And I went to the liquor store and I bought something clear. And I fixed a drink, and nothing happened. I fixed another drink, and the magic of the booze happened for me again. I didn't have to think. I didn't have to feel. I didn't have to do. I could just be. Just be. Those two drinks lasted for over a year, a little over a year. And in that year, I commenced to drinking around the clock like I'd never stopped. And I'm drinking 24/7. I have got to have booze in me. It became an obsession, a true insanity that condemned me to drink against my will. And drinking against my will took me to places that are not pretty. And I started going to the bars every night. I'm single, so I can go to the bars. And I go to the bars every night, and I'm not proud of this, but it's part of my story, and I start bringing men home. I'm having a lot of blackouts. And I bring men home, and I have these two beautiful little angels there, my two daughters. I got a DUI and reckless driving and went to jail, and that didn't stop me from drinking. Just stopped me from driving, you know. I brought home someone one night that robbed me. Ooh. Now, that was interesting because when I came to and the car is gone and the stereo's gone and my Sterling is gone and I'm going, oh, where, what happened? You know, that didn't stop me from drinking. I lost the home. I lost the business. The husband was gone, so I lost all rights. I stood in a courtroom and I listened to a judge talk about me, and I lost custody of our two daughters, Andrea and Erin. And that did not stop me from drinking. I found out later that in a blackout, I bring home someone one night before I lost custody of our girls. That took away their innocence. He violated their bodies, he raped their minds, and he wounded their spirits. And I had no idea that that happened, and they were 7 and 10. My ultimate bottom was I had developed alcoholic hepatitis, and I did not know this, and my esophagus was hemorrhaging. And I'm still drinking as much as I can, as much, and it won't stay down, but I'm drinking. And my body is shutting down, and I'm having convulsions and DTs and all this stuff, and my vital organs are shutting down, and they find me after a few days, and there's stuff coming out of all of my open places, and I'm not pretty. And the paramedics can't do anything with me, and they call the ambulance. And I remembered they were shouting at me and hooking me up to all these things. And I'm 40 pounds underweight, and I'm not big anyway. But my face was so bloated and yellow. But they are shouting at me to keep me somewhat conscious, I guess. And the last thing I remember in the ambulance was, if I could get a little vodka down, I'd be okay. Because vodka does for me what I can't do for myself. I don't know how long I was in intensive care nor in the hospital, because my next conscious memory was I was in a conference like this of Alcoholics Anonymous in Gulf Shores. I came to you in that state of pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, and I was sitting in a chair like this. And the old timers at this conference in Gulf Shores every February say, Utah, we remember you because you were dripping. I couldn't walk and I couldn't talk, but I was sitting there, and that's all I knew. I had lost everything that was precious to me. And I realized today that not only was I a failure at living, but I was a failure at dying because I couldn't even die. Undoubtedly, the God of my understanding has a purpose for me because here I am. After a few months, I started healing physically, and I'm going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I came to believe that I am powerless over alcohol, and I became honest for the first time in my life. That not only am I powerless, but you know what? My life is unmanageable. I didn't understand how unmanageable it was until I got more sober. No one would sponsor me at the time because of the fact that there weren't that many women in Alcoholics Anonymous, and those that were around at the time thought I was going to die. So they just kind of let me have all the room and the space that I needed. Steps 1, 2, and 3 took me in that emergency room, in intensive care, in the hospital. But since that time, I have had to retake steps 1, 2, and 3. Every time I'm honored and privileged to sit down with someone else and take the steps out of our text, the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, I get to take the steps again. And I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. The first God of my understanding was G-O-D, gift of desperation. I was desperate and I needed this program. And the second God of my understanding in step 2 was G-O-D, which was you, group of drunks. I loved y'all, and I still love you today. And I trusted you, and you gave me hope. With your honesty, with your open-mindedness, with your patience and enthusiasm, which comes from the Greek and means God within, you gave me hope. And I made a decision to turn my will and my life over the care of God as I understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. You couldn't be my God anymore, though. My group of drunks disappointed me because what happened, you went back out and drank. What happened, you went back out and drank, and you didn't make it back to the rooms, and I kneeled at your casket, and I said, "Why am I here?" And you're there. So I couldn't turn my will and my life over to your care anymore. And God became in that third step, G-O-D, good orderly direction. And man, was that awesome. Because next in the book it said, next we launched on a course of vigorous action. And it had to do with a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. And I looked in the book and it said, all these columns, and it said this and this and this, and resentment and principles and institutions and fear and sex conduct. And I was going, oh, I'm confused. I went to a meeting. I said, "Jerry, I need to do a 4-step and I don't understand it in the book. Would you please help me?" I had the courage to do inventory. I just didn't understand it. And Jerry said, "Utah, I prayed this morning, who could I help in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you must be an answer to my prayer." So he sat down with me, and he laid out the 4-step for me. I come as a brother today. I have nothing to hide from anyone. And it's just my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been honored and privileged to be sponsored by men, and I've been honored and privileged to sponsor men, whether they're priests or gay or straight or whatever. It doesn't matter, because the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous do not discriminate. Now, I don't recommend that. That's just my experience. After I did that inventory, I found out that that husband that left me affected every aspect of my life. Every aspect of my life. And I found out not only my self-esteem, my pocketbook, my sex conduct, personal relationships, ambitions, but I found out in that fourth column that during our whole marriage, I was dishonest. I was self-seeking. I was frightened that he would leave, and he did he not? And I was inconsiderate. So all of a sudden, he did not leave me. I drove him away. And when I get to own that, I get to continue with the steps. And I admitted to God, to myself, and to another human being the exact nature of my wrongs. And I experienced at that time a sense of freedom, a sense of integrity, that I am today who God intends for me to be. And I became willing to make amends. I became willing to have God remove those defects of character. And I experienced, when I asked God to remove those defects of character, I experienced humility. Humility comes from the Latin root and means grounded. And I learned how to pray in that third step. And then that seventh step prayer, I learned how to pray again. And we ask God to take the good and the bad, because I don't know the difference. And when I ask God to take the good and the bad, I am grounded. Here is who I am, good and bad. I made a list of all the persons I had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. The gift of that is, there were people that had harmed me, the guy that robbed me, the guy that took away my daughter's innocence. And I found out that on that list, I owed them amends. The big book tells me we disregard the other person involved entirely. I'm honored and privileged to go to all male maximum security prisons, and I share with those guys what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And I look out in that room sometimes and I ask those guys, do you know me? Because that one person or two people or whoever, I owe amends to. And I trust that whenever the time is right, that I will be able to make amends to those men. In the eight-step list, what I've had to do, there's a principle out of that. It's namaste. In India, there's a greeting. Like we say, hey, they put their hands together and they bow and say namaste. And translated, the God in me recognizes and honors the God in you. And on that list of people that I had harmed, I had to see the God in them. And when I could see the God in them, it moved me to be able to make amends. And we made direct amends. And that's what I've had to do. I cleared the wreckage of my past, and I experienced the principle of forgiveness for me in that ninth step. And I took care of everything that I knew to take care of to the best of my ability. And experienced forgiveness. Forgiveness is the fragrance that the blossom leaves on the soul after it has crushed the flower. And I'm walking in a meadow, and how many flowers do I step on? And what does that flower give me but the fragrance on the bottom of my soul? That to me is what forgiveness is all about. Continued to take personal inventory. When I got to this step, God, with his sense of humor, moved me to Auburn, Alabama. So I continue to take personal inventory, and I realize today every time I'm disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with me. It doesn't mean I'm wrong. There's something wrong with me. And I keep looking at myself and watching for selfishness, self-centeredness, dishonesty. I keep looking at me and making sure that what I'm doing is what I'm supposed to be doing. And I go, God, what is the deal? And in the 11th step, I pray. I have my RPMs, reading, prayer, meditation, and I pray, God, what is your will for me? What is it that you want me to do? And God, in his loving way, said, Utah, I want you to be an instrument of my peace. And how do I do that? It came to me that I'm not a human being having a spiritual experience. I'm a spiritual being having a human experience. And so when I get to these places and say, God, what is your will for me? The prayer is in our literature. God said, I want you to be an instrument of my peace, Utah, and where there's hatred, may you sow love. Where there's injury, may I bring pardon, doubt, faith, despair, hope, darkness, light, sadness, joy. That beautiful prayer of St. Francis, our 11th step prayer, goes on to say, O divine master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive. It is in pardoning that we are pardoned. And it is in dying to my ego self that we are born to eternal life. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. The principles for me, and I know we had a workshop on it, but the principles for me are the prayer of St. Francis. If I ever wonder what I'm supposed to be doing, just say the prayer and do it. It's that simple. God said, show up and be an instrument of my peace. We are not saints. That's what the 10th step is all about. Thank God. The message I have is I have had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And when I moved to Auburn, I got into service in Alcoholics Anonymous, thank God. Because we have three legacies. We have recovery, we have unity, and we have service. And my little home group in Auburn, Rule 62 group, said, Utah, would you be our secretary? And I went, well, I'm working at Auburn University and I'm a secretary, so I guess I know I can be a secretary. And that journey ended me into service, not only in my group, my little home group, but also in the district. And I served our district. And then I started going to area assembly. Area 1, Alabama, Northwest Florida. And through events and service and responsibilities and humility and all these beautiful principles that we get to experience, I was asked to serve Area 1, Alabama, Northwest Florida, Panel 53, as a delegate and go to New York, 2003-2004. I don't do this. I do not do this. Because of service responsibilities, I met a gentleman 5 years ago, and he started courting me, and I moved to Huntsville. We got married, and we were married for 4 years, and it was great. He's a wonderful man, also in service and sobriety, and after 4 years, I had learned my lesson. I knew I was supposed to learn something, and I did, and out of our ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. And my husband and I met in that field, and I asked to be released from that commitment of marriage. He is my friend today. He moved to Nashville, and God opened up a way for me to move back home. I'm in Magnolia Springs, Alabama. I get my mail delivered by water. It's the only place left in the continental U.S. that they deliver the mail by water. I'm 20 minutes from our two daughters. I'm 20 minutes from my first husband and his wife and their daughter. And everywhere I turn says, welcome home. It is only because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the steps that we take and the God of my understanding, which is that feeling you have for a friend, as described in the Big Book, that I get to experience welcome home. I have a little job at Magnolia Springs Pharmacy. I'm caretaking a house on the river. I mean, you know, how does this happen? And my daughters are excited that I am with them and close to them. And my oldest daughter, Mom, you're going to be a grandmother, you know. I'm going, oh, no. Yay. I get excited. I slept and dreamt that life was joy. I awoke and saw that life was service. I served and understood that service was joy. Joy being the most infallible sign of the presence of God. You bring me joy. You bring me the most infallible sign of the presence of God. And if you don't feel it, open up to it, because it is absolutely exquisite. I sought my God I could not see. I sought my soul eluded me. I sought my fellow man and found all three. And I want to thank you for being here for me. Thank you.